From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a locally produced film on the proposed open-pit iron ore mine in Hurley gets national airtime. Then films of an entirely different sort, mostly of the sci-fi genre, hit the big screens this summer. Why Present Music has so many community partners participating in its season finale concert on Saturday.
A big part of Present Music in our history is to be part of the community, not just do a concert and leave. It's to come up with themes and concepts that relate to our community.
And a local mystery writer remembers his introduction to Milwaukee crime.
My parents used to take us to the Shorecrest Hotel for dinner, and they pointed out a telephone on a table, which was Frank Ballastreri's notorious phone that was eventually tapped. So I got some look into that world.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The political controversy over same-sex marriage is dominating headlines in Madison and around Wisconsin, but it wasn't that long ago that the debate over a proposed iron ore mine near Hurley dominated the news of state politics. The state legislature passed a measure last year that makes it easier for the mining company, known as GTAC, to apply for a permit for the open-pit mine. That comes over the objections of many environmentalists and Native American groups in the area, who say the mine would desecrate sacred areas and pristine wild spaces. The ongoing mining controversy will get some national attention when a film produced locally airs Saturday on the national network Al Jazeera America. It's part of the network's Fault Lines series. Devin Kuperi and Colin Seitzma are producers with Milwaukee's 371 Productions, which produced the film for the network. Speaking with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, Seitzma explained what it was about the issue that made them so keen to make the film.
You know, this is something that we started noticing and getting into about 2 years ago. Devin and I started researching and noticing that there was an issue with specifically the Bad River Reservation and their particular spot down gradient or downstream from this proposed iron ore mine. And what we ended up doing from there is researching and shooting a little bit of video, pitching it to Wisconsin Public Television, who didn't or they weren't interested at that particular time. And we kept going, and we ended up pitching it to Al Jazeera America for their television show Fault Lines. And they were very interested. And that was, I think, we started filming in late August of 2013.
And you said it was that initial, the Bad River angle was the initial angle to it. As you started studying and over the course of the 2 years, this has been percolating, if you will. How did your approach evolve? What was the story you ended up wanting to tell?
So the first time that we were introduced to this topic was at a conference where Mike Wiggins was speaking, and he spoke about the potential impacts to the Bad River Reservation, the scope of the mine, and which would be, you know, up to 4.5 miles for the first phase and 22 miles for the other phases. And so that's what sparked the interest in terms of why was something that's important about this issue to cover. And as the story evolved with the proposed mining bill and the state Senate, it became clear that this is an important story about the state of democracy in Wisconsin and the influence of companies and the mining company that wants to mine on the democratic process in the state.
So you convened a number of people in the course of making this film, residents of that part of the state, so with the assistance of one of the representatives of the state in the legislature. You brought them around dining room tables, and one of the first surprises we hear is they weren't universally opposed to mining as a practice, but they were opposed to this particular project. What was it about this particular mine they objected to?
Well, one thing about this particular mine is that this will be the largest open pit mine in Wisconsin's history. And, you know, and potentially in North America, it could be one of the largest open pit iron ore mines.
And the significance of an open pit mine versus the kind of mines that many of us, you know, probably remember from years past is open pit, they're really starting from the surface and going down, whereas other mines that have been in that area were underground. People would go into a tunnel and extract the minerals.
Yeah. And so the concern with this particular mine is the iron ore is sitting at sort of a 60% angle, right? And within this iron ore deposit, there is a variety of minerals, one being pyrite, which is when it's broken up and crushed, like it would be in this particular mining process, it's exposed to water and the air, it creates acid mine drainage. And so a lot of people living near the mine are very concerned about that and the scale of how large it would be.
But as we said, they weren't necessarily objecting to the idea that mining could take place in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, they are definitely not opposed to mining. But the particular position of this mine is at the very top of what people would call a very pristine watershed, an aquifer. And so that water that comes up into the Pinoki Range would drain down into the Bad River Reservation, Lake Superior, and all in the Kakagan Sloughs, which is where 40% of the natural wild rice beds are in the Lake Superior region.
And you also spent some time speaking with, I think it was a geology professor from Northland College. What was his take on the issue?
Yeah, so we went up with Tom Fitz, who's a geologist at Northland College, and he showed us asbestos minerals that he identified at the site and other independent geologists in the DNR had also identified at the site. And the main thing he wanted to do is to show us those minerals and tell us about the potential hazard that they could pose to workers, which is when they're ground up, which they would be, they could get airborne, get lodged into people's lungs, and potentially cause cancers, especially for workers at the mine site.
So you mentioned the workers at the mine site. You spoke with the lobbyist for GTAC, but also you spent some time speaking with a proponent of building the mine from within the community. And she makes the argument that many have made in the area that this is a place where jobs are few and far between. What was your sense for how the economy of a place like Hurley would depend on whether or not this mine is built?
Well, I think you can say that if this mine were to be built, that there would be a lot more prosperity in that region, and especially Hurley and the Ironwood area having a legacy of mining, they are very prone to this idea.
At the same time, one of the things we learned about mining is that we looked at the communities in Minnesota that have done mines of similar size and scope, the iron mines, and you see in their communities, they still have a very high unemployment rate. And that's something that's important to consider as well. When you're talking about a mine, one of the things we learned is that sometimes the argument is oversimplified and that there's a lot of complexity to consider. There's, you know, who would get jobs, who would potentially lose jobs, who would make the money, and who would potentially lose money in the community. And so there's a lot of concern from some folks, a lot of folks up there that we talked to, that this would hurt the economy in terms of tourism, in terms of people's way of life in that region that depends on natural resources being intact.
Did you find any common ground between people who were opposed to the mine and people who would like to see the mine built?
Yeah,
yes.
Actually, a lot of common ground. Everybody we talk to are very concerned and caring about the future of their communities in this area, and they want to see their communities prosper into the future, and that was something that was definitely striking.
As we said, you did speak with a representative from GTAC, the company that wants to build the mine. He was reluctant to say that his company was behind the piece of legislation that essentially paves the way for them to apply for the permit. But on the other hand, he – I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but he conceded he thought he was an effective lobbyist. What was his reasoning for, you know, GTAC's role in writing the legislation versus how he said the legislation actually came to be?
Well, this is a very important part of the piece, and it's important for one of the main themes of the piece, which is the state of democracy in Wisconsin. And so we ask Bob Seitz, we show him a video in the documentary of a Republican legislator who is asked, did GTAC write the bill? And he says, yes, they did. This is Scott Fitzgerald. And so we show Bob Seitz the video and ask, what's your take on this? And you'll see that it's something that he denies that the company wrote the bill. And we've also seen in the process of researching this project, and actually later on in the interview, Bob Seitz says, you know, this represents how we did have a big influence in writing the bill or on the legislation. So it's an important question for people in Wisconsin to consider about whether a company should be able to write its own laws.
We also meet a candidate who ran for the Iron County Board of Supervisors and found himself in the middle of big money politics, which I gather is unusual for that particular position.
Definitely. You're talking about Dick Thiede, who ran for the county board and found himself targeted by Americans for Prosperity. And usually these county boards aren't contested. They're asking people to be on them. And Dick
Winner, I think you said the winner of the previous election had gotten something like 16 votes.
Mm-hmm. And then his opponent in that race ended up getting somewhere in the upwards of 130 votes.
And in the end, he does not win his board seat. But it sounds like this is the reality of politics in Iron County circa 2014.
I think that it would be accurate to say that Dick feels robbed of his democracy.
Everyone that is opposing this mine project at this point, that at least that you chronicle in this film, is kind of outgunned or outspent. What is your sense for how opponents plan to continue their efforts to stop the mine from going forward?
It's a good question. There's a lot to be seen in terms of how this story will play out. There's people on the ground are organizing locally to educate and get the word out about it. And there's potential for lawsuits. And a lot of it could depend on who's elected the next president and who's appointed to the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers officials and that kind of thing. So there's a lot to be seen.
This is part of a series of films airing on the Al Jazeera America network. What made that series a good fit for this film and that network a good place to screen it?
The program that we're doing this for is called Fault Lines. And Fault Lines is an investigative program. Their goal is to go beyond the headlines and talk to people on the ground. It's kind of trying to turn up a more traditional structure of talking to talking heads and getting past that and talking to people who are affected. And so that's what we do in our piece. We talk to a lot of the local people on the ground, and that's one of the main goals, is to hear directly from the people as to what's at stake, both folks who are in support of the mine and opposed to it. And another part of the goal of Fault Lines is to hold power to account, and in particular, corporate power, and call out corruption when it's there. And that's part of one of the important things that our piece does, too. That's a big theme of this piece. It's about the state of our democracy, and it's about how a corporation and corporate interests were able to influence and pass laws in the state that were favorable to a company.
Well, it's an interesting film. Colin, And Devin, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Devin Kuperi and Colin Seitzma are producers with Milwaukee's 371 Productions. They produced the film about the controversy over an open-pit iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin. They spoke with Mitch Teich. The film will air Saturday at 6 and 9 p.m. on many local cable and satellite systems on the Al Jazeera America Network. It's part of its Fault Lines series. There'll also be a public screening Saturday evening at Camp Bar in Shorewood. Well, it's summer and time for Hollywood to release its blockbusters. Our film contributor joins us next to give us a preview, so stay tuned. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. Even though it's taken a while for the Midwest to get the message, it is summer, and that means that Hollywood has either released or is about to release its crop of summer blockbusters. Lake Effect contributor Dave Larson says if you're a sci-fi fan, this is your summer. If not, well, there are other movies out there. But if you want that blockbuster experience this summer, you pretty much have to get on board the sci-fi train. Larson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express and spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about Hollywood's sci-fi trend.
In recent years, blockbusters have become almost synonymous with superheroes or fiery explosions, alien invasions and car chases, sometimes all of the above. This summer offers quite a few blockbusters of that description, but also at least one alternative, human-sized young adult love story, The Fault in Our Stars.
And we talked about that one briefly a month ago, and I just thought it sounded like a teen drama, but you think it's going to end up being a blockbuster?
Oh, it obliterated everything else at the box office that opening weekend. It's a modestly budgeted movie because you're paying for cast. You're not, you know, doing a lot of computer-generated animation. The expensive blockbuster wannabe that opened that weekend, Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, was a very expensive movie to make, and it was just knocked out completely by Fault in Our Stars, which cost very little to make, which proves an adage that people in Hollywood sometimes forget. You can make a lot more money off a modestly budgeted success than a hugely expensive, you know, pull out all the stops kind of movie that just doesn't quite pull in enough people.
So The Edge of Tomorrow, has that been downgraded from a blockbuster? It was intended to be a blockbuster.
There's the blockbuster wannabes versus the real blockbusters. Yeah, definitely Edge of Tomorrow was intended as a blockbuster. I guess come the end of the season, we'll check back at the numbers. Maybe it'll have staying power somewhere in the world. And the thing to remember, too, that some of these movies that don't do very well in America, Tom Cruise has not been very successful as a star draw in America in recent years, but he sells lots of movie tickets in China and places like that, and lots of people live in China. So, you know, a movie like Edge of Tomorrow, if it appeals to a huge overseas audience of that kind, could still end up, you know, doing well, just not here.
Are there any that are the, I'm air quoting here, classic action movies? I mean, well, there's The Expendables 3.
Yeah, there's that. Well, you know, do you call Spider-Man movies science fiction? I guess not, really. I mean, well, no, that's not even true. They are because they involve this gigantic laboratory and chemical, pharmaceutical giant experimenting with DNA and trying to find cures for disease. That's science fiction, I think, by definition, too. So really, most of the movies we're talking about here under the category of blockbusters could also be called science fiction.
Yeah, that's unusual, isn't it? There's no Bourne Identity or any kind of intrigue movies or Bond movies this summer.
That's correct. There are fewer of those and lots of movies that would fall into the sci-fi category.
Why is that?
Well, probably because enough of these movies have been successful in the recent past.
All right.
I suppose that science fiction at its best opens up, you know, other worlds than the one we live in now. It's kind of parallel to why is there always a market? Why did there seem to be a big market in recent times for historical movies, movies set in other periods of time, times that really did exist and happen? I mean, I think maybe if you want to spin something fancy here, you could say that futuristic movies as well as historical movies appeal to people who don't like the world they live in now. They both open up windows to other times and other possibilities.
All right. Well, let me just harp on one more thing, which is it seems like most of these, over 90% of what we're talking about today, are remakes.
Yes.
Or they are the continuing in a series. Which one is an original here?
Well, of the ones we mentioned, I don't think anything really. There are some movies coming up. Guardians of the Galaxy, I don't think that's ever been made into a movie before. I could be mistaken about that, but I don't recall that. It's a Marvel comic, but a bunch of cosmic misfits, basically. It's got a big cast. It may very well do well. And if you're looking for something that at least has not been done to death already, like, Godzilla, for example, that might be a refreshing alternative.
Yeah, what about Godzilla? Anything that we can expect different from the classic?
Well, it revisits some old themes. I mean, the atomic energy problem of the possibility of mutation and other unintended consequences from the use of atomic energy, something very important in the minds of the Japanese makers of the original Godzilla movie, which to me is the 1954, I think it was. Japanese Godzilla is still my favorite of all of them, and they kind of milk the concept to death, creating new monsters. Well, this is kind of like one of those latter-day Godzilla movies where there's it's not just Godzilla anymore, but there's some even worse creatures out there that for some reason Godzilla decides to battle them and in effect save humanity from something worse than itself.
Have you seen that one?
Or yes.
And something you recommend? Doesn't sound like it.
Not really, no. I mean, were some of the battle scenes between monsters, impressively staged, I guess. There was a good cast in this movie that was not put to much use at all. The dialogue was very stiff and wooden, and the acting followed suit, even from very good actors. So I think as a great cinematic experience, it falls short.
All right. And what about X-Men? I mean, that's a franchise that keeps going, and the quality seems to be kept up, even though it's part of an ongoing story.
Well, that is probably the most interesting of all of these types of movies for a number of reasons. I think X-Men just is a really interesting comic book universe concept. And this movie has the cast of two previous X-Men movies, the first X-Men movie from a decade or so ago, and the 2011 prequel. And so you have Patrick Stewart on the one hand and Hugh Jackman and Ian McClellan, and then you have Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy and Jennifer Lawrence. So you're teaming all of these people with their own interesting real-life stories as actors and interesting backstories as characters, and you have time travel here and the X-Men of the present or the future going back to the past to prevent an all-out catastrophe in this world. So it excels far beyond most of these movies. Bryan Singer, who directed the first of the X-Men movie, came back to direct this one.
All right. And you think that it's – you don't think it's become tired, if you will, the storyline?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. all of these things are in danger of becoming tired, and many of them truly should be laid to rest for a few decades. I guess they tried that with Godzilla. There was a box office fiasco, Godzilla, in the late 1990s, and then nobody revisited Godzilla for a long time, and somebody thought, well, the name Godzilla theoretically sells movies just by itself because almost everybody knows what Godzilla is. And if you have any interest, if you've ever seen any of these previous movies, and many of us have, the idea is that, oh, here's a new Godzilla movie. I haven't seen that yet. That's a selling point. That just the name Godzilla might cause me to go wandering out to the movie theater on opening weekend or second weekend to see this. I mean, and that, cynically is at the bottom of much of this. I mean, yes, is there a possibility of creating a very creative story around the monster Godzilla? Yes, I think you could do it. I don't think they did that in this particular iteration of it. But, you know, creativity and artistic expression aside, I mean, one of the key factors behind all of these movies is, you know, this is going to cost us a lot of money to make a believable-looking monster. We want to – we're not going to do this unless we think that we can draw in or suck in or, as the case may be, a lot of people who want to see something called Godzilla or X-Men or Transformers or Spider-Man or any of these other familiar names.
All right. Well, how about then Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
Well, that it could be very interesting, and I hope it's a blockbuster. I don't know, you know, if it's designed, you know, to be at that level, but it could be. The Planet of the Apes remake from a couple of years ago surprised me because I come in to see these kinds of movies not expecting a whole lot. I come expecting that the only reason for making a Planet of the Apes remake yet again is just because of what I said before, the familiarity of the name. And I found with the, I think it was a 2012 Planet of the Apes, that yes, I'm okay. They're really onto something interesting with this one, the origin of the whole Planet of the Apes saga. How did it happen? You know, here we are with science running amok. I mean, I guess it's Godzilla in a way too, but it was done here in Planet of the Apes in a more interesting kind of way. And the sequel, the new Planet of the Apes movie, picks up, as I take it, where the last one left off. We see the rise of the apes, humanity on the run. The special effects last time were quite good. I expect them to be good in this one too. So I am looking forward to Planet of the Apes.
Okay. And I'll lump the remaining two that we haven't discussed into one category for no particular reason. Transformers 4, Age of Extinction, and The Expendables 3.
Well, Age of Extinction, we have Mark Wahlberg brought in on board this time to bring some fresh face in this movie, this series about shape-shifting alien robots, you know, and their attack on the world. So, yeah, you like the other three. Why not like the fourth one, I guess? I mean, and Expendables 3, well, you know, I guess the Expendables 2 did pretty well, so we have a 3. You know, if three bombs, there won't be a 4 for a long time.
All right. And something I also noticed, that there's no zombie movies.
Yeah, well, some things just sort of run out of steam after a while. I mean, we had an awful lot of zombie movies for several years. And we also have vampire movies, too. So right now, we seem to be back into more of a cycle of alien invaders and scientific monsters of some kind. I don't think that zombies or vampires will leave us alone for long. There will be more of them.
All right. Well, how do you pre-grade and pre-rate this summer, then, compared to other summer blockbuster seasons?
Well, you know, I would have to say it's about on par with recent years. Maybe it's a good question to ask me a month from now when I've seen a few more of these movies as they're released and I can actually speak to them from firsthand experience. But for the time being, it follows form.
All right. Hope it goes well this summer. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express newspaper and the author of its I Hate Hollywood blog. He's also our regular film contributor, and he spoke with Dan Harmon. Present Music explores the meaning of home in their upcoming season finale concert. We'll talk with music director Kevin Stahlheim next on Like Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. Tomorrow, Milwaukee's premier new music ensemble, Present Music, will take over Catalano Square and later the Cabot Theater in the Third Ward's Broadway Theater Center for their season finale concert. Home Place is an exploration of what home means, and it involves a number of community partners, including some of these kids from Lindsay Heights and the New Life Community Center. They made musical instruments from everyday materials, like this guitar.
This is beads and silver pieces, and that's a coin. And It's kind of sharp, so you don't want to touch it. And beads.
Or this percussion instrument.
It's made of a sink, a board, and like some chains, and then a can, and then a pitcher frame. It's like a maraca.
This kind of collaboration is standard operating procedure for Present Music, but they have perhaps outdone themselves this time with a number of collaborators. In addition to the kids from Lindsay Heights, there are contributions from students from Burnham Park and from Sherman Washington Park, from the Gospel Choir of the Clinton and Bernice Senior Center in Harambe, from the Milwaukee Opera Theater, and artist Reginald Baylor and his Typeface Project. Kevin Stahlheim is the artistic director of Present Music. Christine Liu is the organization's general manager and the coordinator of the community partnerships. Stahlheim explained where the idea for this concert came from.
Well, as usual, found a piece of music that I really liked called Shelter, and it's written by the Bang on the Can composers, three of them. They often do these really large works where the three of them contribute various movements or whatever. And so this work is like 65 minutes long. And they work, especially Michael Gordon works with a filmmaker. His name is Bill Morrison. And I just love his work. It's just incredible. And so this is a, you know, it's a long 65-minute piece with several different movements. And it has film that goes along with the whole piece. And so I just wanted to do that. And obviously the word shelter can bring up some ideas. And so I thought of home and shelter and place and maybe away from home or all that can mean. And thought it would be pretty interesting to build a concert around, you know, the concept of home and shelter and place. And that's how it started.
And so part of that, Christine, is this stuff that's going out into the community. And can you tell me a little bit? There are four sections or four pieces that involve that.
Yeah, we are working in four neighborhoods. This was inspired by artist Reginald Baylor's Typeface Project. He went into four neighborhoods: Lindsay Heights, Harambe, Burnham Park, and Sherman Washington Park, and had community conversations with residents. And based on those conversations, the words turned into public art installations. And so sort of inspired us to apply our creation project education programs, where we pair local composers with students in the Milwaukee area to write new music. We thought we could work in those four neighborhoods as well. And so three of the neighborhoods will be creating new music, and one of the neighborhoods with the idea of home and shelter, students are going to create miniature musical shelters made out of recycled materials found in the home.
And how is that all connecting to the concert? Are parts of what you're working on in the communities, is that going to come into the concert as well?
Yeah, it's sort of one of our vintage big event Present Music concert things. And so we're going to start outside in the park next to the Broadway Theater. And a lot of the kids and the performers from the neighborhood projects are going to do things outside, and in addition to other things, actually. And then we're going to come inside and do the concert. And so we're connecting the outside and the inside and the neighborhoods and the concert together into one whole.
Yeah. The technical rehearsal should be fun.
Yeah, especially if it's raining.
Yeah, right, like today.
I'm trying to imagine just the technical, the corralling of all of those. How many people are you thinking are going to be involved?
Well, I think Christine knows the most. I mean, for the concert itself, the work by the Bang on the Can composers, it's pretty big, but it's not huge. It's maybe 15 instrumentalists and three singers. And then we're going to have Milwaukee Opera Theater and our new vocal ensemble, Hearing Voices, are going to do some pieces. So that's 12 more singers added on. And then when it comes to the kids' involvement, I think Christine probably has better handle on the numbers in each neighborhood probably.
Yeah, I would say in Burnham Park, we're working with Carmen High School students. So it's probably around 35. At the Urban Ecology Center in Washington Park, I would say around probably 15. And the Clinton Rose Senior Center Gospel Choir has about, I think, 12 to 16 members. Yeah.
And will all of them be there for the outside part of the concert?
Yes. So the idea is to sort of put them in different locations in that outside area. And then the musical shelters that are done by students in Lindsay Heights will be on display outside, and then we'll bring them into the theater.
For the concert. Mm-hmm. Okay, very cool. Why is Present Music the perfect organization to do this kind of thing?
Uh-oh. You're asking me why Present Music is perfect. That's maybe... Well, I think because, you know, a big part of Present Music in our history is to be part of the community, not just do a concert and leave, you know, come in, go out. It's to come up with themes and concepts that relate to our community. So we've done water. We've done all kinds of things, and this is, you know, home and place. And so, you know, it excites me to come up with a vision that doesn't just have sitting in your chair, listening to music and leaving, but involving the community somehow. And it is tricky because, like, a lot of what we do is, you know, a lot of people would say it's avant-garde or whatever, but I think a lot of what we do is also very accessible. And so it's a tricky and a fun challenge to me to bring in people that know nothing about new music. And, you know, some people are actually really going to like it, some people not so much. And then I think we also get inspired by the non sort of avant-garde world. So a gospel choir or some kids making some sculptures is that's inspirational to us as artists to see the real world, you know, and to connect it all. So I think that's why we're good at that, is because we like to do it. We believe in it.
Christine, from your perspective, why do you think this is a perfect marriage of all these different parts?
I think it's really cool to see, like, the concept of home place and looking at, you know, the repertoire that Kevin picked, which are by, you know, leading composers in our country and our world, but then to also have an element featuring Milwaukee and how that is our home as well, and looking at, you know, these different neighborhoods and having residents, you know, essentially create their own new music, and then sort of having everything come together so that people that live in Harambe can check out what people in Burnham Park are doing. I don't know if, you know, if that happens that often. And for us to do that, you know, celebrating Milwaukee as our home and
making those connections.
Yeah, is really cool. And it's not, I don't think it's possible for lots of other types of organizations to do that. It's good for us.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great.
Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to hearing how it all comes together. Has it made you think about home and place differently as you've been working on this project?
Well, yes. I mean, when I look at the music that's on the concert itself, I think a lot of people, when they think of home, you know, it's home sweet home. It's home is where the heart is. It's cozy and all that kind of thing. And there's a lot of stuff on this concert that's pretty much the opposite of that. And I think it's good to, you know, think about what it means, not just to me or just to us, but to a broad range of people. And so I think it, you know, it just makes you more connected. It makes you more aware of the world around you. And so for me to see some of the film that Bill Morrison did is just really, it's really moving stuff. And it's sometimes scary, sometimes it's tender. And I think, you know, going into these other neighborhoods, I haven't done that part of things. Christine has. But once we start to actually meet each other, you know, to me it's like, I don't know, I guess I would say it's almost different worlds meeting each other over the same theme. And that just is always exciting to me.
And creates a new home.
Yeah.
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 And Christine, have you thought about home differently?
I think with the, like, looking into these neighborhood projects, you know, seeing the Typeface project, going on that tour and you know, these community conversations, they're pretty raw. Like Kevin was saying, not all of the answers of the residents that live there are like, oh, I love, you know, I love my neighborhood. A lot of them had, you know, really personal, some of them are really sad stories. And those stories became part of the artwork that's out there. And so I think it's cool that, you know, we're giving another life to that project and allowing, you know, the students and the seniors that we're working with the opportunity to sort of share their concepts too of home. You know, why here, why Milwaukee, why my area? Yeah.
Kevin Stahlheim is the artistic director of Present Music. Christine Liu is the general manager. Home Place takes place tomorrow evening at the Cabot Theater in the Third Ward's Broadway Theater Center. We'll take one last break and then hear about a new murder mystery set in a fictional Wisconsin town during a particularly damp summer. Stay tuned for that conversation when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The rain and fog earlier this week have lifted, but if you enjoyed them, a new mystery by a local author might be just the meteorological ticket. The Summer of Rain, Odyssey of a Young PI, plays out in a fictional Wisconsin town during a profoundly damp summer. The investigator is Bobby Broyles, new to the job, and a man who finds himself wrapped up in a soggy morass of corruption, murder, scandal, and slimy funeral directors. The hard-boiled mystery is the work of the mild-mannered John Kolb of Whitefish Bay, who's previously written plays and short stories. Kolb sat down with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio and talked about what makes a good mystery for him.
Well, certainly suspense, as the name goes. I also like good dialogue. It's one of my favorite parts of writing as a writer and a reader. And then I like characters that are memorable. So those are some of the ingredients that I was hoping to put into my book.
From what I know about you, and I don't know a ton about you, but I don't believe you were a part of the culture of corruption and crime syndicates and drugs and snitches. what draws you to writing about that world?
I led a pretty sedate life. I went to grade school, was born, and lived within about a two-block area. I guess my first introduction to Milwaukee crime, my parents used to take us to the Shorecrest Hotel for dinner, and they pointed out a telephone on a table, which was Frank Balistrieri's notorious phone that was eventually tapped. So I got some look into that world. But I guess it's more I like reading books that have strong dialogue, and I like the noir world, both movies and fiction. So that kind of got me interested in trying to mimic some of the better ones.
Who are the detective and mystery writers who have been important to you through the years?
Well, there's a guy that not everybody knows, the late – his name was Westlake, but he wrote under the name of Richard Stark. He wrote a series. I like that very much. Recently, literary fiction writer named Dennis Johnson wrote something called Nobody Move that's really nice. And then movies like Chinatown and the earlier noir ones were all kind of models for me.
I detected kind of a Raymond Chandler quality to this as well.
Well, he certainly everybody owes a debt to him, and I've read some of his and some of the others down to Elmore Leonard. I haven't read all of anybody's.
As I read it, one of the – not to harp on the Raymond Chandler thing, but I remember reading something about the making of The Big Sleep, and by the end, not even the people that were working on that movie knew who had done it and how. And there was certainly something in the really tangled web that we read about in this book that was intriguing.
Well, it was a while before I knew how it was going to end. I kind of dove into it. I had a character, a situation in mind, and I was really sort of desperately searching for how to conclude it. And then when I got the idea, I had to go back and fix some things up to make it a little more plausible.
Well, so let's talk about that. How did this story or where did this story start for you?
Well, years ago, I was in a small writing group, and this is about 20 years ago. The owner of Von Trier's on the east side was assassinated in his parking lot with a crossbow, a very bizarre kind of crime that I don't think was ever solved. So the four of us thought, hey, we should be rich and famous. Let's write a mystery. And I was the only one who did it. So I did that. And then I did a second one about a young detective just starting out in this field. And then I set that aside and a couple years ago totally rewrote that. So that's how I kind of got introduced to the idea of writing crime fiction.
Well, and where did Bobby Broyles come from?
Different places. The fact of having a factory accident and then starting his life over mirrored something that happened at a place where I worked. A young man did get injured, and the company paid for him to go back to school and start his life over. And I kind of like that.
Not necessarily as a detective, though.
No, actually, as a computer programmer, which makes it hard to have a central character doing computer programming. But no, but so that was kind of one model. Another thing was in Chinatown, for the second half of the movie, the hero has a bandage over his nose, which is kind of a reminder that he's not in control and the world is dangerous. So the idea of having my hero have a scar, if you will, of the dangerous world came into mind also.
Well, and so what sets this book in motion? Paint a picture of where things are, both for Bobby and what he's setting out to accomplish and solve as the book opens. We don't want to give too much away because part of the fun of the book is seeing the twists and turns, but give us what sets the thing in motion.
Well, one thing that I hope is a little different in this book is that Bobby is trying to start over, but he keeps going back to his parents to try and have them bless what he's doing, and they have different ideas of what he should be doing. So his mother has ambitions for him beyond the factory. His father says, why isn't it good enough for you?
But his father was also at the factory.
Correct. He's kind of a minor technical star at the factory. And Bobby's comfortable. But his mother always implies he should do something else. And so Bobby has that in his head. So when that comes together with this accident and some money, that's kind of what turns him to trying something new. And he doesn't have a college education. So this is something he can try out.
How much did you like Bobby when you started putting him on paper?
I actually did like him. I had some feedback in writing groups of this guy is kind of wimpy, and early on he does stumble around. But I kind of wanted him to be like that. I wanted him to not be like Humphrey Bogart, always in kind of command and control, sort of lost. And so I did like him. He's certainly not totally admirable. He hopefully is a mixed person that readers will enjoy following and find interesting, but he has his flaws.
And he's certainly learning the ropes as he goes here.
Absolutely. Stumbling. And when he first got into it, I mean, in the real world, he probably would have spent 10 years staking out motels and nothing. And it's just sort of a fluke that he gets pulled into something that's more substantial than that, namely the disappearance of the wife of a kind of mysterious businessman. Pretty important to have a little more drama than what the average private investigator actually does all the time.
Well, and it's his good fortune that he's been hired, because this is a guy who is perfectly happy to keep paying him to look for his missing wife.
As bad a detective as he is originally, he's still getting paid well and wrestles with some of the dilemmas that involves. He's aware that he's kind of a bought person and doesn't know where he's going and kind of wonders, why am I getting paid, but I'm glad I am.
And he finds himself in a situation where he's working with a cop who is also kind of new to the scene, or at least new to this city.
Yeah, they kind of pair up. He pairs up with a couple people. He has a lawyer friend who's struggling in his life, but he also has this cop that is new and trying to find his way in a new town. And they're sort of kind of partners and kind of adversaries. So they work together.
Bobby spends a lot of his time getting beaten up.
He does get beaten up often, and he's pretty resilient. He awakes in hospital rooms any number of times, looks around and wonder what's going on, and asks himself, should I keep trying this? And just one other thing that kind of eventually got into my head was to have him at least, while it's, I think, a light, good read, there is this theme of guilt, because as he keeps stumbling around, he keeps endangering people around him. It's almost like a Job as things are crashing around him, and he wrestles with, you know, should I get out of this? I'm hurting other people. That's a theme that runs through it. Not too heavy, I don't think, but it brings a little moral issue to it.
Well, and as you say, you didn't necessarily have a solution in mind when you began. How much fixing did you have to do as you went along to make sure that there weren't all sorts of continuity flaws? This is a really tangled web you have woven.
Yes, it is tangled. And I did, as I say, I did have to go back. And there are certain scenes that absolutely I had to tweak to make it, by the end, the total surprise. I think it's a total surprise. I haven't yet had anybody say I saw that coming.
And there are no butlers in this in
there are
this
no
book.
Butlers in there, and there's no Mr. Plum or any of that.
There's a reference to Mr. Plum, as
there,
I recall.
There is a joking reference to that, yeah. But so I had to go back and try to make it, because as I thought about it, I did wrestle with, is anybody going to believe that this could be it? And I hopefully, by retracing it, I fixed it, I think.
Why did you decide against setting this book in Milwaukee? The actual setting is a bit ambiguous, but it is a small city somewhere in the Midwest.
First of all, I knew if I specifically named a town, I'd have to be really careful, and I liked the freedom of not having to do that. If there is a town that, as I thought about it afterwards, my mother grew up in Marinette, Wisconsin, and there was an article in the paper recently about the sudden explosion of the drug trade in Marinette, Wisconsin, and that kind of mirrored what goes on in my story is that it's surely as Bobby is having growing pains, the town is having growing pains as suddenly crime is escalating in a once kind of innocent place. So I liked the freedom of not actually naming it, and I could invent stuff that seemed to work for me.
Did you have to do – there are a couple of sidebars or tangents that the book goes into, and one is this world of funeral directors that Bobby finds himself in. How did you immerse yourself in that world?
You've named some of my favorite characters, the funeral directors, and I – apologies to all real funeral directors. I don't really know what you're like, and you're probably not like these people. And so there again, I maybe was freed by ignorance that I could just kind of imagine that maybe some of them have a public persona that isn't exactly the same as what they say behind the scenes. And yet I'm sure I exaggerated. So, I mean, there are probably plenty of people and ethnic groups that get insulted in my book. I really don't mean it.
It is probably not giving anything away to say that Bobby survives this mystery. Is he going to ride again?
First of all, I'd like some overwhelming demands from my fans to do a sequel. Hasn't happened yet. But I have started. I've put about 40, 50 pages down on paper. So I have some thoughts of maybe doing it again. I do allow him to live, yes, so we can go on. If a trilogy is needed, I'm ready.
Well, it seems like just from reading it, you must have had an awfully good time writing it.
It was fun. The dialogue was fun. I love doing characters and not being under the obligation to have a huge amount of depth to them, painting them in a brush stroke or two. And that's kind of what I enjoyed. And I like the colloquial language, too. I like writers who write in that, dramatists or short story writers or whatever.
Did you go out for Latvian food when it was all over?
The names came from a couple guys I knew in high school, but I did not. No, I don't know if there is one in town, in fact. There probably is.
Well, John Kolb, it's a fun read. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thanks for having me on and asking some good questions.
You bet.
John Kolb's new book is called The Summer of Rain, Odyssey of a Young PI. It's available at local booksellers and online. There are links from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Kolb, who lives in Whitefish Bay, spoke with Mitch Tyke. And that is all for the Friday edition of Lake Effect, with thanks to our production team of Mitch Tyke, Stephanie Lecce, and Dan Harmon. We get production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, Brooke Dowden, and Audrey Nowakowski. Web support from Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. And I'm Bonnie North. I hope you have a great weekend. Hope you'll join us tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, and be back here again Monday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.